Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have with me Daniel Friedman of Burnalong, coming to us from Baltimore. How are you doing, Daniel?
I'm terrific, Nathan. Thank you.
Great. How's your day going so far there in Baltimore?
It's a great day. The sun is shining. We're busy, so it's a happy day.
So I was watching some food show at the gym about the blue crabs. When can I come eat blue crabs?
Well, in Baltimore, they sell it to you all year round. But the summer's a good time.
Okay, great, awesome. So what is Burnalong, and why did you start this business?
Sure. So the reason that we started the business, myself together with my co-founder Mike Cott, is specifically for myself. I looked at my grandmother and a whole host of health issues that she had, from cancer to weight gain, and problem after problem, the doctors said the same thing, is like, you need to exercise more. And the challenge was, is that unless someone from the family was there with her in person, she wouldn't exercise. And so you could put up every single program on TV, it wouldn't get her to do something. And it's a similar situation for Mike. And as we looked more broadly across our friends, family members, there's just story after story of heart attacks, obesity, diabetes, stress, insomnia. Like, the circles are filled with people who didn't live life or enjoy life as long as they ought to, but for whom all of them, exercise and different wellness classes would have made a difference. And so we asked ourselves, why, when you're at home, when you most need support, are you cut off from the friends and family members who motivate you? And so what Burnalong is we're a health IT video platform that focuses on fitness and wellness. And so we use a combination of personal relationships, and that's bridging online and offline experiences, local choice and machine learning to drive engagement, getting the results for people that they otherwise aren't getting when they're at home or away from the people who motivate them.
Okay, interesting. Give me the first person use case. Is this, do I go onto the website or download some apps in iTunes and it coaches me, or is this more like a social network that's connecting me with people I care about to work out together?
So it's both. So what you're able to do on Burnalong is you can choose from hundreds of online video fitness and wellness classes from hundreds of gyms and studios across the country. So in the morning, you could take a yoga class from New York City. In the afternoon, you could take a cardio class from Nashville. And you can take that class on your own, on demand, whenever you want. Or if you want, you can invite others to join you in live private sessions. And it's geared towards all ages and levels, from kids programming through to programming for seniors, and across all categories, from boot camps to bar to yoga to tai chi to mindfulness. There's even sleep yoga. So anything in the fitness and wellness space, there's something for you.
Interesting. So the cardio class in Nashville has a camera set up and they're streaming their class, recording it, and so I can kind of virtually join that class if I want.
Exactly. You can take it on demand whenever you want. So you're traveling for work, or you've got meetings ran late and you can't go to your favorite gym in person, or maybe you're not a member of a favorite gym, you could come onto our platform and you can access it via the website, via TV, via an app, and take that class right then and there. Today, Nathan, you've had a long day and you want to just relax at the end of the day, you could practice some mindfulness with Burnalong at the end of the day.
How much of it is recorded classes versus live synchronous classes?
So it's split. So right now the classes themselves are recorded, but you can take them in live real-time sessions with others. And it's only people that you've invited. So you and I could be live with each other, speak to each other, push each other, taking a class live together, though the class itself is recorded right now.
Interesting. Okay. Very interesting. Great. And so how long have you guys been around for? A couple of years, 3 years?
No. So we founded the company in April 2016, and we launched to the public in January last year. So it's really been open just over a year.
Awesome. Congrats. Thank you. So let's talk about fundraising. That's what this show is about. How did you finance it in the beginning from 2016 till the launch a year ago?
Sure. So we first bootstrapped it, and then we started approaching investors, and this was split between some investors who'd known us from the past, from previous ventures, and so were once we said that we're starting something, were interested in supporting us once it got going, through to then starting to speak to investors who align with what we're doing, whether it's people who understand the space and invest in the space. Often it's people who are personally dealing with the challenges. So a lot of people relate to the fact that it's hard to find the time and motivation to exercise. If you just look at the numbers, 80% of the country doesn't get the recommended levels of exercise. And you look at all the health problems that leads to. And so for a lot of investors, it might have been for themselves or for friends or family members who they were trying program after program and it just wasn't working for them, and they appreciate our unique approach.
Hmm, interesting. What were you doing before this? You mentioned you approached people who knew you from before. What was your previous life?
My background is I started off as a journalist and worked in policy, and then spent 5 years in the intelligence community, working with governments around the world and companies around the world with a focus specifically on rehabilitation programs. And then moved to the tech space, started in HR tech, and then founded Burnalog. The red thread for me throughout has been like a fascination with human behavior and what motivates people to take action, which is really at the core of what Burnalog is we're not just another fitness or wellness platform. Our expertise is in actually getting you to take that action.
You're hacking the engagement retention side of things, I guess, right? Kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it's focused on that. You know, you look at most people, they make a New Year's resolution, and then a month later, they've given up on it. And so the question is that like, how can you get people to stick to it? And that's, you know, where our both the technology that we have and a lot of our expertise lies in.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I dread January when I work out pretty consistently at the JCC here in San Francisco, and every January, you know, it just gets crowded as all hell for a month and a half, and then it goes back to normal.
and then people feel guilty the next New Year's, New Year's Day when they're making their new resolutions. But for most people, it's a struggle to find the time. You know, if you've got kids, for example, at 5:30 after work, are you going to run to the gym, or are you going to have dinner with your kids? And so if you can instead get your favorite class and your friends at 8 o'clock at night after the children are asleep, you know, you're more likely to exercise and stick to it.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. Is there a virtual reality component to this, or is it, do I put my iPad in front of my stationary cycle, or how do I actually do this?
Yes, you can do it through your iPad. You can connect it to your TV. So there's a whole host of ways, and you know, VR and AR come down the line, but right now it's through your computer, tablets, or TVs.
Got it. Okay, so you launched this last January 2017. When did you start raising money for it?
So we raised some money in 2016, and then we just did another raise a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. In 2017.
Okay. So you started raising, you know, your more significant round, which I believe was $1 million. Is that correct?
Yeah, we just raised $1 million in 2017.
So when did you start raising that?
I think we started conversations probably about like 3 to 4 months before it closed.
Mm-hmm. And how did you, I have on my list here, Baltimore Angels, Brown Advisory, Johns Hopkins University Endowment. How did Macomb Capital and Tedco, so kind of not unusual, but not your standard, you know, seed funds. How did you approach raising money in Baltimore for this?
Sure. So we did it as a convertible note. So it wasn't an institutional round. Some of the investors who invested in this round were investors previously, and so they saw that we did what we said we were going to do, and they wanted to increase their stake in the company. For others, it was actually people who had passed on when we first raised money, thinking, you know, listing a whole lot of objections to why they think the company wouldn't succeed. And then they saw that we did what we said we were going to do and saw the traction, and so they wanted to invest. And for others, it's really relationships that were built up over time. Or some of the investors came in because they were, in the case of a couple of them, they were looking for a solution in this area and were introduced to us. And, you know, we fit essentially their hypothesis on the market.
Is that like Johns Hopkins? Is that the one you're referring to?
There are a couple of the investors that fell into that. Yeah, into that bracket. I mean, you know, the great thing about the wellness space is people are increasingly thinking about it. And so if you're in that situation where you're thinking about it for yourself, you're thinking about it for a friend or family member, and you've got a specific thesis on the space, then, you know, all stars align for an investment in us.
It makes sense. How did you identify a target list of investors, and how many did you reach out to or talk to?
I think probably we spoke to, I think we probably maybe had about 50 conversations with different investors. And this was a mixture of a lot of people who we thought would be interested in our approach, people who we thought would be value added investors, existing relationships, or people who we had spoken to beforehand and built relationships with, and then really narrowed it down, and just filled out the round that way.
Okay. So mostly you were kind of stepping back to when you first started raising money, you were looking at mostly wellness folks and people who you had a relationship with.
Yeah. I mean, people who were thinking about, you know, were thinking about the space, and there's a whole different ways why people can think about it. You know, some people are coming from the industry and so understand the online offline relationship potential. For others, they focus more on the wellness space. So a couple of different avenues. There's obviously a broad space.
Yeah.
Fitness and wellness.
Well, it is a broad space. And then that's where I keep hammering on this. Like, how did you identify folks that were interested in this space, or, you know, building a thesis around this? That's not easy to get inside people's heads.
So some of it is you're at different events, you network with people and you hear like who's asking about things. A lot of inbound, like people, for some people, once they hear about you, they want to learn more. So we dealt with a lot of like inbound requests for people wanting to learn more and then going from there. You know, and as much like, I think the way that we viewed it is it's as much like getting to know those investors, because if you're bringing people in and they're getting a stake in your company, you want them to be people who you like to work with, who are, you know, have good ideas, do what they say they're going to do. And so there's a set of criteria that we had now with people who we knew from the past or we built relationships with. You know whether someone does what they say they're going to do. You know, a lot of people, they promise to make a whole bunch of introductions and then they don't. You know, that's, you know, could be a sign of what it would be like actually if they weren't an investor or they were on your board. So it's, you know, it really is, we viewed it as a relationship building opportunity.
Sure. Okay. So you launched in January 2017. By the time you were starting to engage with investors, what level of traction did you have? Can you share any metrics or details around that?
Yeah, so we'd gone from having like a hypothesis to having more than 100 gym and studio partners signed up. And so it was no longer, you know, if we looked earlier on, the objections were, for example, like gyms and studios wouldn't partner with you. Mm-hmm. But by the time that we were doing this, the 2017 raise, we'd already proven that people would partner with us. And so the conversations were very, very different, and people could see it wasn't just a hypothesis. They could see, actually, all right, practically, this is how it's playing out. You know, I don't remember exactly how many states we were across at the time, but I think it was like more than 10 states. And so people were able to speak to partners, were able to speak to our gym partners, were able to speak to users and really get a sense of how the company was growing and playing out.
Totally makes sense. So you were able to prove, you know, gyms are signing up. How about on the other side, the fitness folks? Were you able to actually demonstrate that this was doing what your thesis said it would do and keeping people in the, you know, exercising longer?
Yeah, exactly. No, we had a lot of that data to show people. And of course, people could try the product for themselves and understand it. You know, once you work out live with someone else from home, it's a very, very different experience to working out on your own from home. And so people could, you know, investors try the product, see it, they speak to users, they speak to partners, and really get the sense of why this is a very, very different type of play here.
Tell me about raising money in Baltimore. I haven't had any guests on this show from Baltimore. I've never been to Baltimore. I don't know what the startup ecosystem is like in Baltimore.
So it's a smaller ecosystem than, say, like New York or San Francisco. There's a lot of well-known companies or well-known brands in the area, especially as it pertains to our space. So, for example, you've got Johns Hopkins University and Hospital System, which is one of the top ones in the country. You've got Under Armour, for example, which is headquartered in Baltimore. You look at like Olympic athletes. I think there's more medals coming from Maryland than any other state. And there's a big gaming community. You've got the NSA and other government entities pretty close by. And so when it comes to a talent, there is a big base. There's not as well an established ecosystem. So there's not like lots of different angel forums and places you can go. So it's much more about speaking to other entrepreneurs who maybe a couple of steps ahead of you, seeing who they would recommend speaking to people at the different companies, different institutions, and getting recommendations. And so I'd say it's probably there's fewer investors, and so it's a deeper search than you would in a different city. We did take investors from other cities as well, part of our network and part of people hearing from us.
Did Under Armour's success create an Under Armour mafia of success? It seems like that would throw off a lot of, you know, wealthy people that maybe would then become angel investors and maybe have relevance, especially to what you're doing.
I think where Under Armour, where it gets interesting is Under Armour is a relatively new company. And so there are people who remember what it was like before Under Armour and saw the growth and see what the potential is for building really like a top international brand here. And because of, you know, the work that Kevin Plank and Under Armour does in Baltimore, really contributing a massive amount to the city and to the state, there are probably a lot more people focused on the fitness and wellness space plus the big hospital systems here than you would otherwise. So it definitely adds to it and helps our cause.
Interesting. But it didn't necessarily spin off a bunch of angels that are, you know, some, like I had an interview with a guy in Boston last week, and HubSpot's IPO created quite a few new angels, kind of the HubSpot mafia. Not necessarily the same effect with Under Armour's IPO?
Not for us, at least not from, you know, our investors. It's been really beneficial for us in other ways, but not from a cash perspective.
Gotcha. And tell me about Baltimore Angels. Are they the only shop in town, only angel group in town? Are there multiple ones? Are they kind of the big one? What can you tell me about them?
You know, I say they're probably the highest profile one. There are small groups of individuals who get together. The Baltimore Angels is like an established network. It's got a track record. There's a proper like process to it. And so, you know, I'd say they're the most well-known of Baltimore groups.
What kind of deals do they do? And, you know, for put yourselves in the shoes of another Baltimore entrepreneur looking to possibly raise money for them, what tips would you pass along?
I think, as really with like every investor, it's about understanding who are the members of the group, what are their passions, what type of metrics do they like to see, and this could differ. You know, like in Baltimore, you also get a lot of technologies coming out of Johns Hopkins, and for those, it's very, very different to a consumer play. So I think, as with most investors, like the Baltimore Angels, is you really need to identify like who within that group would be a fit for you, who would get what you're doing, and then go from there. Because, you know, some things on the medical side, some of these technologies won't be launched for 5-6 years. You know, a lot of the value is in the patents and what's been developed and the opportunity and the validation on the hospital side, versus a consumer play, or a marketplace or a product play. You know, it's, you're looking at sales and numbers. But I'd say just in general, is angel groups outside of, this is my experience at least, angel groups outside of major cities are more conservative, mm-hmm. than say in New York and San Francisco, or especially San Francisco. So they want to see more traction than you would in just say in San Francisco.
I hear that from multiple parties who are not in San Francisco. That seems to be a common thread. Very,
you know,
good.
Not to say that is like a criticism. You know, I mean, these are people who earn their money and they want to invest it how they want. You know, what a lot of founders here in Baltimore talk about is it forces you to, you know, you have to go that extra mile and be extra disciplined, because people aren't throwing money at you from the get-go. And so you've got to be very careful, show real traction. Maybe it takes a bit more grit to get going than in cities where cash comes more easily. And then as you think about like subsequent raises, you've got that extra bit of grit and you've been through more that puts you in a better situation. So, you know, it's not necessarily a negative thing that is harder.
Yeah. Good. Any other resources that, you know, Baltimore entrepreneurs should check out? Any meetup groups, any incubators, accelerators you would refer folks to, you know, someone kind of fresh on the scene, where would you point them to check out?
Yeah, I say like two groups that stand out. One is TEDCO and the Maryland Venture Fund, which is supported by the state. And there's a lot of resources, they make investments, so there's and they're really under George Davis's leadership. He's the new CEO. They're really pushing to do more, and so they're focusing on underrepresented groups, really trying to help the ecosystem grow. And then
what was the name of that again? I'm sorry.
It's TEDCO.
TEDCO.
Yeah, and the Maryland Venture Fund.
Gotcha. Okay.
And the other is really what's being done at Johns Hopkins and Christy Weiskill, who's really leading a lot of the renaissance in Baltimore, with a lot of events, opportunities, resources for entrepreneurs. There are a couple of others, but those are the two where we've got support from and have really just great things to say about them.
Very nice. Where do you, last question or two, where do you see you going from here? Will you raise another round in Baltimore? Will you look outside to the coasts? You know, what's your kind of funding strategy from a high level?
Sure. I mean, for us, is we're starting to identify investors for the next stage for us. And it's a mixture of people on the East Coast, some in the West Coast. And I think then it's going to be a process of speaking to them, learning if they'd be a fit for us. You know, as you know well, it's not all money comes is equal. And so you want people who are going to be with you in the long term. I mean, one of the biggest things that I've heard from friends and other entrepreneurs who've either sold companies or some that have folded, you know, they say, just remember, all money isn't equal. And if someone is unpleasant to deal with when you're raising money from them, what do you think they would be like as a board member or an investor when things aren't going well.
Yeah.
And so you want people who are really going to be with you when things are going well and not going well, because every startup goes through ups and downs. And so one of the most helpful things that I found and led to whether we've taken money from people or not taken money from people is speaking to other entrepreneurs who've worked with them, because you really get a sense of are those investors, are they really going to be in your corner and give you support that you need?
What kind of things do you ask fellow founders that when you're doing kind of the diligence on that?
So it's like when you didn't meet a target or something went wrong, and there are a million things that get wrong, like someone pulls a client or you have to deal with an issue, how would they react? Would they be the person that you would call, or would you be afraid to call them? How did they react? Are they easy to get hold of? Do they provide good guidance? When they commit to doing something for you, do you have to chase them down over the next couple of months to follow up, or do they do it? You know, and a lot of entrepreneurs speak about, investors, and this is the experience I've had with a lot of our investors, of when we've got a problem, you pick up the phone and, before they invest, they're negotiating against you because they're representing their money. But once they put in the money, they're on your side. And so they are there ready for you to, you've got an issue to talk through. They jump on the call, they support you through it. And it's those type of characteristics that you really look for from other entrepreneurs when you're speaking to investors. There are a lot of warning signs it's obvious what the warning signs are when an entrepreneur is speaking natively, that they had a problem and this is the investor just gave them a headache about it, or didn't come up with constructive solutions, or created additional problems for them, or wouldn't do what they said they're going to do. Those are all, those are all negative signs.
Yeah, no, those are great, great questions to ask. Very good. Any last bit of advice for, what would you tell yourself if you're doing this all over again, or any advice for other Baltimore entrepreneurs getting off the ground or recovered it?
Yeah, I'd say is that it's very easy to get depressed when you're getting no's, right? And the majority of investors you speak to are not going to invest, right? It's a numbers game. And I see the most important thing is to realize it is a numbers game. And for you as an entrepreneur, if you get the money from good investors, if it took you 50 meetings or it took you 100 meetings, it's not the no's that matter, it's the yeses that matter. And don't get caught focusing on the no's. Look at it and think back, well, what could I have done different in the pitch? But it really is it's not you, it's me situation. Like, investors have their hypothesis, they're looking at certain stage companies, and it really is like a matchmaking game. And in the same way that you're not going to be upset that every other person in the world doesn't want to date you who might be in your broad category of people you would date, it's really the same thing with investors. It's about finding a match and focus on the yeses and then celebrate the yeses. There's so many, being a startup is a roller coaster, and it's that with fundraising, it's really in every area, and you really have to celebrate the highs and celebrate the successes, because that reminds you that that's really what counts, and not to get caught up on the lows.
I like that. That's good advice. Don't get caught up focusing on the no's and celebrate the yeses. That's a great way to conclude. Well, thank you. Best of luck for Burn Along. I'm going to have to check this out because I could step up my game a little bit here. I still have the holiday pounds on a bit. Awesome, Daniel. Appreciate it. Thanks. Have a good week.
Thank you, Nathan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye.